Faith, give me a little 1-2.
1-2.
4-3-4-5-6. Check.
You ready, Scott?
This is recorded. We're not live, so we can edit. Story of my life.
Oh, jeez.
Ashley, were you expecting a professional podcast?
No, I wasn't. Apparently not. Sorry, guys.
Thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Scott Warr.
And I'm Don Freeman. And today, Scott, today is a day I've been looking forward to for a very long time. And I'll tell you why.
Since you were just a little boy.
It probably has been that long. We're sitting in front of two very distinguished guests, two of my mentors, my trail mentors. And that's really part of the topic today, trail mentors. There is no way that any one person can run these distances without a little bit of coaching, a little bit of mentoring along the way. And we were sitting here talking, and we'll introduce a guest in a second, Scott.
I was wondering what you were going to do.
Well, I was wondering too. And so we think about it a little bit. Who can't right now just think, who's my mentor? And these two mentors of mine, they could tell you right who their mentors were, because there was mentors before them. So,
and we're going to ask them, right?
Yes, we will. And we're going to compare notes and make sure they listed the same person. The people in front of us today are Steve Harreld and Dana Gard. And there isn't a bit of my running, something in every run that I do each day, that doesn't have a piece of their advice and their help along the way. So with that, I'd like to thank them. They both run Western States and have been completed them. Steve, say hello and tell us a little bit about your running background a little bit.
I'm Steve Harreld, and I was a marathoner in the day, and have more than 50 marathons. And like so many people these days, and in those days, it was all about taking the next step.
Right.
A friend invited me to go up and sit at the track, one Western States. This would be in 1988. His words were, "You need to come and see this thing."
That was it, huh?
And when I started, when I was present and saw those folks rolling in, that's all it took.
Yeah.
And so.
So you saw these people coming in after 20 plus hours on the trail, and you said, I got to have some of that?
I'm looking at them. I'm looking at their condition. I'm looking at the elation, and I'm wondering, where have they come from?
Ah.
And what have they done, and what have they experienced? And I went my first trip up. It was like I was seduced. Huh. I was in. Yeah.
We all remember our first time, Steve. Dana, tell us about your first time.
Where did that come from?
I don't know.
I'm Dana Gard, and I started my first marathon was 1978, the old Sacramento Marathon, which is now the Urban Cow.
Right.
And I think I ran 9 of those in a row before I decided maybe I ought to stick to the trails. And
were you trail running before that? In your training?
In my training, I was doing some trail. I started trail running in 1981. In 1980, I'd qualified for Boston, and when the times used to be a little faster than they are now.
I didn't know that. The qualifying time slowed down.
I think I needed to be a sub 250 marathoner.
Oh wow!
At that point, and. Later on, it got even tighter. I went under had to go under 240 as a master at one time to qualify.
Why do you think they opened those? Why do you think they lengthened the qualifying time? What are your thoughts?
They were in the mid 80s when I finally went to Boston in 86. There was only about 4,700 official competitors, and there were just a few more other competitors. So Boston decided that they needed to start filling the field. So that's where they went to the 310s and the and the different times.
I don't even know how many people participate in Boston now.
Now there's, roughly at least 10,000.
Oh, okay.
So follow the dollar.
Yeah, follow the dollar. But I was qualified for Boston in 1981, and I kind of went up to Folsom Lake, to Granite Bay area, and just kind of started nosing around on the trails.
Uh-huh.
And it was early in the year, and I met some people. That mentored me a little bit that particular day. Herb Tanimoto, Nancy March, and a couple of other runners that they showed me where some trails were and talked about AR-50, which they had run the week the year before. Was the first year, and Nancy March was the race director at that time. She was Fleet Feet Roseville. Mm-hmm. She was the owner of Fleet Feet Roseville, and I had I was kind of low on money, so I says, okay, I'm not going to Boston. I'm going to do AR-50. I came home, and my wife says, what?
So I want to know how you made the leap. You're running marathons. You go out on the trail for one day, and you say, I'm not going to go to Boston. I'm going to run a double marathon.
People had talked about the 50-mile run. I was running out of Southside Park at lunch hours and things like that. So I was running across people that were in around events. Kurt Sproul, who was the director of Western States back in the early 80s, one of the first race directors, he ran out of Southside Park. And I
was part of that crew.
Yeah, and Steve was part of that crew.
Okay.
Mike Savage, who was part of that crew for off and on, and actually Dave Cox, who was an attorney. Remember Dave?
Yes.
Yeah, Dave was out of there.
What is it with all these lawyers wanting to run long distances?
it's about their therapy.
Is it stress relief?
Yes, very much so.
Yeah. But I decided, and I ran AR-50. My first year was 1981. Downhill direction.
It started up
in the parking lot of the fairgrounds.
Okay.
But it came down basically the same way, similar way that we finish.
There's a few times I've run AR-50 where I wish that I didn't have to climb that last gasp and just run down it at the beginning of the day.
As I found out, that wasn't particularly the easiest way to be running the bike trail at the end of the AR-50.
Later on, I found
out that it was a lot easier. It was a lot nicer to run the uphill direction than it was the downhill direction.
What did an aid station look like?
Oh, yeah, great question.
Well,
how many aid stations were there?
Were there aid stations?
There were aid stations, but it seemed like if there were six or seven aid stations, that was about it.
What they featured?
Gookinade.
We've talked about Gookinade.
Gookinade?
Yeah, we've talked about it. We've never tried it.
It was nasty stuff.
If it tastes bad, it's good for you.
At the start line and going down the hill, it's probably the first time that I pay attention to Gordy Ainsley. I had like an 8-ounce mustard bottle for liquid.
A mustard bottle? Wait, stop there.
I've heard about Aunt Jemima bottles. I've never heard of mustard bottles.
The Aunt Jemima bottles. Pete Schoner, who started the Apple Hill run in 1977. He started that run. Pete still runs with still uses a Aunt Jemima syrup bottles.
Oh, yeah? Yeah. But, so you used a mustard bottle.
Yeah, I used
a mustard
bottle.
Did you have any kind of hand, I mean,
No hand grip holes, or anything? Nothing. Kept my finger over the spout so it didn't leak.
what was in the mustard bottle?
Water.
Just straight water.
8 ounces of water.
What else are you consuming during this thing?
Water.
What, did,
really?
No Succeed tablets. I hadn't really. That first year was kind of like drinking water and maybe a little bite of something off the aid station, but hardly anything. At the finish, I was a little kind of laid down. I was a little spacey. I didn't need an IV, but I did lay down. I was a little
How
spacey.
Many runners?
There was approximately about 450 runners.
Many women?
Yeah, quite a few.
Okay.
Back then, there was a lot of women.
At least 10%. At least 10%, which was a good number for many, many years.
Was it hard to find mustard in the town?
It definitely was.
It was like before a race.
But as I went down the hill, I had a 8-ounce mustard bottle, and Gordy Ainsley's jogging along beside me. He had a 1-gallon bottle, milk carton with this,
of course.
And I know it was Gookinade. It was the orangey, crappiest looking stuff. And I'm just looking at that going, well, okay, I guess this is.
you have a little to learn about this.
For a little learning trip.
Where was the finish line?
The finish line was in River Park. We came down pretty much the same way that we come down now, other than there were not, the bike, all of the bike trail wasn't there that we use now. The section after after Beals Point. Mm-hmm. Going down in through there.
Mile 27 or so.
It was bent over grass. We were running along the running along the road, and we could see cars, you know, along the edge, and but it was just bent over grass, just make a trail.
I want to back up to an aid station, because today when we pull up to an aid station, we see, you know, potato chips, Oreo cookies, we see power, you know, I don't know about power bars, but we see some, what kind of bar?
It's Cliff like
bars.
A convenience store.
Cliff bars. We mm-hmm. have some electrolyte drink. We have some salt to dip into. These are the things today
pizza?
That we see.
Pizza.
In some cases.
Grilled cheese.
Potatoes.
Grilled cheese.
Yes.
At the end of the day, we may have some soup, right, that's there.
Soup, so, brownies.
Let's talk about the early aid station.
There wasn't much there. There was a few M&Ms, little bit of potato chips, and
they have boiled potatoes.
And I'm trying to think when the boiled potatoes came in. It was maybe just a couple years later that boiled potatoes came in. I think it was mostly potato chips.
Are you carrying anything?
Sally Edwards for electrolytes was using rock salt.
Yes.
Rock salt.
Yes, we did.
In fact, you bet. I bet Sally still uses that.
Do you crunch on that, or do you just put it in your mouth and suck on it?
Second one.
Yeah.
Suck on it.
Pinch between the cheek and gum?
Just like tobacco.
A lot of people were going to McDonald's and getting salt packs.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Were you carrying anything? Do you have a fanny pack?
I had a little pocket that I had my wife sew to my shorts that I could put a couple of things in. And I had a couple of pieces of basically a couple of pieces of candy.
Did you chafe back in those days? You guys were tougher than we are now. So was there any chafing issues? And when did you first learn to de-chafe?
I chafed a lot on my first couple of marathons till I got rid of the jockstrap.
At what mile did you get rid of the jockstrap? About mile 18?
About the third marathon that it's like, you know, this is not working. Not enough Vaseline at the aid stations.
What was your time the first time you ran this thing backwards?
AR-50?
Did you win?
8:13. It was my first time. Wow. No, I was just taking it easy. I just want to finish. I don't know what I'm doing.
Who were the speedsters?
The speedsters were guys like Bruce LaBelle. The real speedster was Jim Howard.
Mm-hmm.
Howard won three of the early AR-50s, and he had the downhill record for like a 5:32.
Wow. That's so fast.
Wow.
Something
50
in that
miles
range.
And 5:32.
Yeah.
You know, tell us a little bit about, and you guys can hear the theme of this. You know, we have these guys that were at the beginning of our sport, and so many of us have jumped in either recently or a decade ago, but not as far back as the birth, the explosion of this. And so if you could tell us a little bit about what was the atmosphere like at races? Has it changed between early day and now? Give us some commentary.
Well, I'd say that the races now are more technical when you look at the starting field.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's so much equipment out there.
What kind of equipment?
Unbelievable.
GPS watches and that type of stuff?
The GPS watches, the altitude watch, the...
A water bottle with a holder?
Yeah.
A water bottle with a handhold, all of the...
That's technical,
the vest,
Dana.
All of the running vest. In 1983, my first Western States, I'd been training with a guy named Gordon Hall, and we were just buffalo chips, so we knew each other. And so that was kind of like, okay, let's train and do stuff. And I had met a guy named Dave Weber that year, and Dave came from bicycling. So it's like, okay, yeah, a water bottle is a lot better. A bicycle water bottle is a lot better. And he also had a pack.
Like a fanny pack?
He had a double water fanny pack that nobody had ever seen before. The only thing that people had, guys like Doug Latimer, that was one of the early great runners, they had a Boda bag.
Huh.
Yeah,
you know,
the
Boda bags went around your waist, and it was the first before Camelback started the aquas and things.
Uh-huh.
And he would change those. He just had those. I'm like, man, that looks interesting. And we didn't see it soon enough before the race. So I was going to carry my bottle in my hand and this little oversized fanny pack that I had. But I trained with this guy Dave Weber. I met him off and on, and he had an experimental pack.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, some guy in Sacramento is trying to make these, and I'm kind of trying it out on the trails and doing different stuff. So the Friday before my first Western States in 1983. Dave comes up and he's got 13 of these packs called Aqua Packs. And it took two bottles. I'd never run with a double bottle on my thing, but I bought one for 20 or 25 bucks and said, this is what I'm going to use. Never wore it before in training. And
try nothing new on race day.
How did it end up?
Did it make the whole trip?
It ended up okay. Uh-huh. I mean, it helped. And the particular one I got had a little flaw in it where the bottle set up a little higher, so they kind of rocked a little bit. Mm-hmm. The strap at the bottom of the opening for the bottles fit in, didn't let the bottles settle down as well as they should have. So, of course, I've got one of the 13 experimental ones. And they sold those for a few years. They lasted a little while until all of the companies like Ultimate Direction came in and started taking over the business. And the Ultimate Direction packs were much better thought out than the original Aqua packs.
Now, you know, we see such a change in race demand, you know, of just trying to get in to some of these races, especially the premier races, and we've kind of talked about that on our website. We have a question of the week that's been talking about premier races. Should you qualify for a 100-mile run with a 50-mile run? Perhaps you should go run a 100-mile run somewhere else before you get into the Western States, Hard Rock, Leadville. You're smiling, well, Dan. You have a thought
Western
about this.
Western States, well, not particularly a thought, is Western States used to have a 50-mile qualifier.
But by Western States.
You could use any.
Okay.
But to enter Western States, you didn't need to have the qualifier done. You could do the qualifier after you accepted to Western States.
On your honor.
Really?
On my honor, I will do that.
And if you didn't do it, then you didn't make the starting grid.
Interesting. When did that change?
That changed in about 85 or 86 mm-hmm. was when it
interesting.
Changed. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that Tweetmeyer would know that since he's been around with us this all these years too, because he started as a 12-year-old, I think.
But Dana is portraying a very interesting aspect of Western States from my vantage point, and that's one when it was very local. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it was much smaller. It was very community oriented. Uh-huh. Tim Tweetmeyer was the face of the event, mm-hmm. and he was the ambassador of the event, and marvelous in both respects. And when I showed up for this, it was the Norm and Helen Klein show, and Norm ran it like a dictator. And I think for the most part, the names came out of the bucket. There were no names coming in from the dark, as we have today, and it was marvelous. And I grew up as a runner and as a man, as a person, as an adult under his tutelage and learned a lot from him. And it was a lot less fancy in those days. But the bonds between people like myself and Dana and others were absolutely extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, my mentors were people who lived in the mountains.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And for me, it was about training, running with people who were far superior to me. And that was possible because in those days, the ultra community was very, very inclusive and very, very encouraging. Mm-hmm. And that was the other thing that really drew me into this thing. And I think that has affected Dana and I in the same way now as we mentor and open ourselves to younger folks, which we really enjoy doing.
Yeah. So I would assume when you were first running Western States back in the early 80s, when you showed up at the starting line, you probably knew half or better of the runners that were running that race.
You really did, because
most of them came from around here, right?
Most of them came from around here, even though there was a draw for Western States starting in 80 or 81. Was, you know, you still had to have a draw. So I had to have a draw, but for my first time in, and I decided to run Western States. After I went up in 82 and watched people trudge out of Bath Road, up into Forest Hill coming out of the canyon.
So you saw the pain and said, so I got to have some of that.
I saw some of this and I'm like,
who doesn't want to do that?
Yeah. Do I want to really, is this possible? I guess. And it's like, kind of like, well, I guess if I go slow enough and slow and slow and just learn how to, learn how to survive, then.
Isn't that the qualifier for ultra runners? You know, the more we talk to different ultra runners, you know, via, you know, the podcast and people that are listening, they all say that very similar stories where I think the majority of the public, if they saw what you guys are talking about at the track at Western States and coming up Bath Road at Western States, seeing the pain and anguish, and you, most people would say, okay, that's dumb.
Yeah,
that's stupid. What are they thinking? Yeah. But I think the mentality of an ultra runner is,
I want some.
I want some of that. Where did that come from?
Well, I want to cross that finish line.
Yeah.
Because I know I can.
Yeah.
I have no clue what this is about. When I finished my first AR in the late 80s or early 90s, my late great father was there. He was always there for me. First words out of his mouth were, because I thought I was a hot shot rolling in at a pretty good time.
Yeah, there's a humble factor here.
Could you go out and do another 50 right now? And I just thought, oh my God, there's no way.
Yeah.
There's no way. And we did it repeatedly several times.
Yeah.
So
I'm interested. We talked about, Don mentioned at the very beginning of this podcast, you know, mentors. Who were some of your early mentors and who did you learn the most from in those early years?
Well,
and what did you learn? Two-part question. Yeah. Who and what?
You've always got the two-parter, Scott. I can barely keep track of one-parter.
A and B. You want me to write them down on a whiteboard?
Yes, please.
Okay.
I worked with a gentleman named Chris Delgado. And Chris was an... Chris came up from Fresno years ago. He and his brothers, he has three brothers, all runners, and all good runners. And Chris came up and was working at the city of Sacramento, which is where I retired from a few years ago. And he kind of got us, let's go out and run. So a few of us from the engineering department went out and ran a little bit of lunch hour with him. We'd go to Southside Park and do a few miles. I started out with like a mile and a half, if I was lucky. And half of that was walking. I was playing tennis at the time, so I was in fair shape. To start with, so I could at least jog along for a mile and a half. But Chris had got me going. He had done a marathon or two, and out of the blue ran a 50 miler down in the Fresno area, and which he'd never said anything about or whatever. So I kind of went out and did AR50 on my own and didn't tell him. And then we kind of, let's run some trails. And we started running the trails a little bit, and we ran together for about five years, training on the weekends and races. We would run races together. We had fun. People thought he was my dad in the early years. Tweetmeyer still says, how's your dad? But we had fun over the years, and our wives knew each other, and we'd do a few things and stuff like that. So we started out as good friends. So I always considered Chris as my mentor. And we talk a couple times a year now, and he ended up injuring his Achilles in 86, and that was pretty much the last of his running which I was very sad to see happen. But
part B of the question was, what did he teach you? Do you have a takeaway that you would say, you know what, this is what I learned?
Well, he kind of taught me some patience out there.
Yeah.
And then he taught me patience, but he also taught me when to speed up.
Uh-huh.
You know, where's the patience? Where do you take advantage of the course? And
so
it's more geographic.
Where do you pick up speed during in a course, not necessarily against your opponent?
Yeah. And then he taught me about interval training. He taught me about that, or the first parts of the interval training, that was like, oh, you want to be a little faster, we need to do a little of this and a little bit of that.
Yeah.
We talk about it, about what we need to do in the future to reach a goal. I mean, we'd run together. I think our fastest marathon together was 2:49.
Wow.
Running step by step.
Yeah.
Our fastest AR-50 together was 6:49, running step by step.
That's crazy.
I'd run some fast. I've run quite a few faster than that over the years, but to stay with somebody all day long and come up with something like that, you know.
I'll sprinkle in a few of my mentor, takeaways from you guys, because you're right on that topic, Scott, when you said changing your pace through the race. And it was the first time I got to run with Dana, and I knew Dana as just, you know, remarkable runner. His reputation precedes him. He peels off his first place division AR-50 jacket before the run. I think, you know, and I'm making sure. I'm wondering if my basketball Converse shoes are going to be okay for this day.
And that's wasn't how much, that quick. It was
quite it was close. Kind of exaggerate a little bit. And so I'm running behind Dana, and I'm thinking, this guy doesn't know how to run. I'm going slow. I'm going fast. I'm going medium. He can't hold a pace. I don't know if I should say anything, but I'll just. And then all of a sudden, I started to pick up on it. Wait a minute. He is adjusting his speed to this course. And if I'm. And it's an inverse relationship between his speed and the profile. And it seems like the work is always constant. And I had the courage to finally think, Dana, maybe there's something to what you're doing. Here's what I'm observing. And he says, and this is the takeaway that I run.
Are you going to quote?
I can't quote him. But it's something to this effect, because he's sitting. If he wasn't here, I'd quote him.
Okay. He can't be corrected.
That's right. It's, Don, you've got to keep your work steady. Regardless of what the course does, your work level should always be the same, whether it's up, down, or flat. And that's how you successfully run long. You must have a steady workload. And whether it's 70% effort or however you want to define it, you've got to stay even all day.
And that's a common mistake of beginner trail runners, is they go out there, they've run some roads, and they think that they have to
take advantage of the downs and go like crazy and extend themselves beyond, you know, not being steady. You've got to stay steady. So I thank you for that lesson.
You're welcome. Dana.
Steve, who were your... Oh, sorry, you had a question.
No, it's regarding the mentors. It's a two-part thing for me, as I was sharing with Dana a minute ago. My mentors all lived up in the hills here.
Yeah.
It was the Tebows, Gene and Susie. It was a wild-ass highway patrolman living in Auburn named Bruce Malden, who was an extraordinary athlete, and John Demarest, who at the time was a dentist up in Colfax, and he was another extraordinary Western States individual and an extraordinary person. They lived up here. This was not my neighborhood. This was their neighborhood.
And how did you meet them? Were up there running, or did you meet them?
I think I probably met them at a Western States event of some kind, but they quickly embraced me. Maybe Bruce did, because I'm also law enforcement. Uh-huh. And so they introduced me to the mountains. They introduced me to the landmarks. I listened intently to their stories. Mm-hmm. They had tons of stories, and they were very competitive among themselves, and mm-hmm. I took note of that. Mm-hmm. But then you had your mentors, and then in the course of this early on, you develop your own personal peer group, mm-hmm. uh-huh. separate from the mentors. And my peer group became people like Dana, Bill Finkbeiner, mm-hmm. Wayne Miles, Bill Hambrick, Mike Hernandez.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Those were my homeboys on the trail. And those are the individuals that, and Helen Hull in the day, spent tons of time with these people. And with this gentleman in particular, seated to my left, Dana Gard, who was just, it's a privilege for me to be in the same room with him, literally.
Yeah.
And I say that with all sincerity.
I see it.
Listening to his stories, and he and Finkbeiner in particular remember everything.
Yeah.
They remember every race, every distance, what the weather was, what the result was. I can't do that. I don't
remember what mile I'm on.
No, but I so appreciate that about him. Always giving, always sharing, always positive. But when I'm watching Dana run, and I can see it in my head right now, it's this sleek body, this sleek cat, just moving over the trails, all at one speed. And what I learned from people like Dana is run smart and beware of the mood swings on the trail, because what's happening here is going to be different than what's happening down the next mile or two. It's just like life. It's a life's lesson.
Yeah.
And that's what people like Dana have meant to me. And it's just wonderful, these associations.
Yeah, and it's it's fun to talk. It was so much fun to talk to people on the trail that you just met or different stuff. Sierra Nevada a few years ago, probably in 05, Bill Finkbeiner and I, we were running it together, and like we've done for a few races, over many races over the years. And we were on our way back, and we caught up with a guy, and says, "Oh, yeah, how you doing? Oh, okay. No, this is my first time out here." I says, "Well, we've done this before, you know." And
you did a lot of the cat of bag. This was like the 15th time.
So Bill and I were chattering, and pretty soon, oh, guy's still with us. And you know, we were just talking and back and forth and whatever. And pretty soon, we says, "Well, don't you want to go ahead, bud? Don't you want to go ahead?" He says, "No." I says, He says, "I want to hear you guys."
Yeah.
And you guys know the name Jimmy Dean.
Oh yeah.
Oh really?
It was Jimmy Dean in his first ultra.
Oh wow. That's funny. We're gonna have to relate that story.
You bet, Jimmy. Yeah, Jim, he's on here a lot.
He still comes up to me and says, "Thank you guys." And he's a neat guy. And
he is a great guy.
I ran with him at Woodside, one of those 50Ks. Yeah. I ran with Jimmy the time when we went down to Woodside a few years ago. And gentleman, a scholar.
Yeah, a real ambassador for the sport. You know,
for sport, and those are the type of new people we need in this sport.
Mm-hmm.
And did appreciate his comments. As far as mentors, when we were talking about the mentors, I did have an experience in 2002, and I wasn't running that much. I was a little overweight, and it was January, and I'll show up at Cool, Bill and Wayne. Yeah, okay, I'll show up. And they had ladies with them, new ladies. I'm like, "Oh, okay, hi, ladies." Spent the whole six months up to Western States training with those ladies, and teaching them things. And they would ask us questions, and they would get lost out on the trail if you didn't watch them closely. And that was one of the most fun things that we did over the years, and they got me going again. Over the years, and I kind of got back in shape for a couple of years after that, and because of them, it helped me get back and to where I had wanted to be on the trail at times, and I really appreciate it. All those ladies over a 2-year period finished. Five of them finished the first year, and the sixth one that had a problem with her knee finished the next year. One of the gals was a little slower than the rest, and I remember we'd be standing at Devil's Thumb or over at the cemetery before we went down, and she'd just come up to me and she'd just look at me and she says, "Can I finish? Can I really do this?" I says, "Yeah, you can do this. All you have to do is learn how to keep moving. Keep moving.
Mm-hmm.
Don't stop and don't do that." So that year, the race of 2002.
That's one of the great things about this sport that I've enjoyed, because I'm relatively new to the sport.
Scott, you've been saying that for 10 years.
Relatively speaking,
okay.
I'm new
right.
to the sport,
right.
especially when you consider the people in this room.
All right.
That is something that I've enjoyed is, like you mentioned, it's very inclusive. You can meet somebody out on the trail running, and the conversation comes very easily.
Yes.
I don't think you see that, at least I haven't, when you're running down a paved road early in the morning and you pass another runner, you're lucky to get a "Hi, how you doing?" If you're on the trail, you may even stop or start running together.
Exchange names.
What are you training for?
Right.
You know, where are you from?
Well, I know you're also a tourist out in this extraordinary environment.
Right.
Mm-hmm. With these vistas and these views. And it's so great to share it with somebody you don't know, and here we meet, and you know, it's absolutely amazing given the urban life that most of us live. And while we're out doing that, most folks are home sleeping or reading the newspaper.
That's right.
I don't think I've ever had a run early in the morning, or for that matter, any trail run, where I haven't thought during the run, "We are so lucky to be out here when other people are." watching football.
Even that
TV.
Time you ripped open the top of your head trying to get underneath that tree? Even that time?
Even that time.
Wow.
I said, Art, you know what? I wouldn't be able to rip my head open anywhere else today except for out on the trails.
I'm going to back up to some of those ladies that you mentored. Yeah. I know one of the names, and as someone that I trained a lot with and mentored me as well, is Julie Fingar.
Yes.
So you took somebody that was aspiring in the sport that became a champion herself and still winning races to developing into a race director and giving back to the sport
right.
a great deal.
Yes.
She now holds AR-50 in her and Cool and many others within her jurisdiction of races and has introduced racing to a lot of people. So you never know how far you're bringing somebody in is going to reach out
Absolutely.
To others, right?
I'd like to point out another aspect of the event, though, or this ultra running culture that we're a part of, and at least for me, it's also very personal.
Mm.
And specifically in 1996 and 97, I ran it. I finished. Both years were sub-24 hour.
We're talking Western States.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And in those 2 years, my late great dad was battling cancer, and he adored Western States. And so our theme those years was survival.
Mm.
I'll survive the 100, and you survive the disease.
Uh-huh.
And I recall that as I was headed to the start in 1997, he was bedridden, and I thought, I really need to get out of here and just go home. And I can remember calling home and saying to my mother, I'm going to scrub this deal, and I'm coming down right now. And I can remember her saying, if you come down now and if you don't run and finish, your father's going to be very upset with you.
Mm-hmm.
So I ran it that year. It was total business for me.
Yeah.
It was
yeah.
one of the best runs of my life. I got the buckle. I go home. I give him the buckle.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
So that's the other aspect of this for me. I mean, it runs real deep, just mm-hmm. like some of the streams and the rivers up there and the forests. It's beyond the mentors, and it's life-altering. It's mm-hmm. life-expanding. And you really appreciate just all the glory and the wonderful things in your life. And I also know, as a person, I didn't do this on my own, and to the extent
Absolutely.
That anybody has a spiritual sense, I have a very deep one as a result of being able to even show up at the start of one of these things and have a dear friend like this man here.
This race means a lot to people, that, and surprisingly, once in a while I'd wear the buckle to work or something, and people would, oh, you know, and people that you were working with, contractors. I was a project manager for the city of Sacramento for years, and the architects that I worked with and the contractors I worked with and whatever, and if it opened up, I'd never told them what I particularly did, but if they happened to find out, they wanted to talk about it. They would want to
right.
talk about it.
You know, I remember a similar situation. I had just fairly, you know, new to the sport and started running a little bit. I'd done some 50Ks, and I think I may have run 150 AR50 or something like that. And I was talking to, I went and was meeting with a customer of mine, Dan Piper. I don't know if you remember Dan
yeah,
Piper.
Dan.
And he had a Western States buckle on. And I knew what Western States was. I said, Dan, where'd you get that buckle? And he goes, well, I earned it. And I, not in a million years, would have pictured Dan Piper as an ultra runner. And from then on, we had this friendship. Dan was a very soft-spoken gentleman. In fact, I remember the first time I met him, I've told Don this, the first time I met him, we went to lunch, and I couldn't get him to say 10 words. I'd ask him questions, and he just would not open to me. But as soon as that belt buckle came
up, opener.
We were friends.
Yeah.
And every time we
yeah.
met, we'd talk about, I said, yeah. you know, when I first got into Western States, I told him, hey, Dan, I'm training. What advice do you have for me? And it was just, it was a conversation opener, and it just created a bond
yeah.
immediately.
Yes.
Steve, I want to get to your comment about being out there and being something when you're running that race or a long race that, and I may be putting some words in your mouth, but, you know, pick it up with me here, about how you get down to the core of yourself and what's really important and love of family and all those things. Everything else seems to get stripped away, and all of a sudden you're to the core of who and what you are. And the only way to get there is to put yourself in the middle of that battle of that 100 miles or 50 miles or whatever extreme effort. It's you seem to reach in and hold on to what's true and real, and you realize that that's really my family and my people and my friends and mm-hmm. folks that I care about and have relationships with.
Absolutely.
And all the other stuff, what kind of car you have waiting for you, becomes a bunch of hooey. Who even cares? Just hopefully there's someone with a car so you can drive you home. But
so you don't have to run all
the time. Yeah, but other than that, it's like family, and you feel like, I just love them.
To have my daughters be the midnight trail people for me was always extraordinary. Mm-hmm. Always extraordinary. I have two extraordinary daughters. And as young girls and as they grew up around Western states. Mm-hmm. I wanted them to be around an event like this, to see it, not to see me, but in particular to see the women runners.
Yeah.
And they did, and they're very much in their own right now, those kinds of women. I last ran Western in 07 and finished at age 60, which is a pretty cool club to be in.
Oh, yeah.
But I can remember telling my daughter Emily, who at the time was 30, well, let's do it one more time. And her words to me were, again, Dad?
But you know what? I bet you that, like you were saying, it formed them. It showed them that it's something you set a goal for and you work towards that you can succeed at things. And sometimes that goal may be considered by others impossible. And by you being there and showing them as a father, and then also seeing these other runners that come through that are beaten and bashed, and see
you
that
bet.
They can overcome that.
And you do it on your feet. You don't do it sitting, looking at a computer or a whatever and using a keyboard. No, you're out there exerting yourself in the unknown.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they also then got to know my friends, such as Dana and Hambrick and Hernandez and all of that. We raised our families together, and it was marvelous. And it is so rich. It is so very rich.
My son is an ultra runner. I mean, he's run a couple of, some AR-50s and some cools. Way Too Cools and a couple of other races. And the first time he asked to come along and be on my crew, he was 11.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay, you want to come? And my wife wasn't sure whether she
Can you
should,
stay up that late?
Yeah.
I couldn't, but he could.
Yeah.
But when he was 11, he came and did that. In high school, he was a 200-pound catcher.
He wasn't
a runner. He was never a runner.
He
until
is now.
On his own, mm-hmm. After mm-hmm. high school, after college, and whatever, he decided to go out and start running.
Because of the example. Yeah.
As an example.
Yeah.
He never came and asked me, well, teach me how to run or whatever. He just went out and started doing it because it made me feel good. And my last Western States, he did pace me my last 38 miles.
Wow.
And
how was that?
That's fun.
That was fun.
And I hope that's still possible today with the young families that are involved, given the fact that the culture and the world has changed so much and there's so many things for these youngsters to do.
Yeah.
I hope some of them still take pause when they're around whomever who's an entrant in Western States or any event like mm-hmm. this.
Yeah, he's out running with all my friends.
Yeah.
you know, Dana, you talked about equipment change, and you talked about GPSs, and I'm going to throw in, as I said, sprinkle in a few of the things that I've gleaned from you, whether you know it or not, and because running with Julie, she was a direct connection to you. So some of the things that she taught me, I knew came straight from you because she says, Dana Gard says this. And that usually meant take pause, listen,
take out
and
your
learn.
Pencil and notebook.
Yeah, that's right. And so GPS, when you started running, there wasn't GPSs. We know that. But here's what Dana taught us is that you need to know how far it is from point A to point B. So how climbing up a canyon, how many switchbacks? And he knew all the switchbacks. He knew exactly and still does how long it takes to get from Sandy Bottom across Sandy Bottom, which is a part of Western States coming into the 78.1 aid station. He'll tell you any section. He'll look at a landmark and say, that bush means we're 5 minutes out. Stay with me. All of those things are so important, even more accurate than your GPS, because you know that bush hasn't moved, right? And so he knows the landscape, but he also knows the landscape this is how long it should take when your legs are fresh, and here's how long you expect to take it when your legs are tired. And if there isn't anything better than knowing what you're up against to get you through tough sections, I know this is a 20-minute section. It just is. And maybe it's going to take me 25 this time. That's okay. But I'm going to just bury my head down and work for 25 minutes. So that's a good one.
Yeah. Well, probably I've heard this three times removed because I think that came from Julie and you when I was up in the canyons trying to learn the canyons. The one thing that I learned from Julie, and it sounds like it came from Dana, was, you know, this canyon from El Dorado to the top, if you're feeling good, should take you this many minutes. Not how many miles it was,
right,
but it should take
correct
you this many minutes.
You bet.
And if you're tired and you're not feeling real well, it should take you this many minutes.
You bet.
And you know the difference between climbing it going one way versus coming down the opposite way. And that was a new way, a paradigm shift, at least in my mind. Don't think about the miles. Think about the time.
The big picture is scary. I mean, if you're just saying, oh, God, today I'm running 100 miles, it's like, well, okay, 35 minutes up this, 35 minutes to climb out of El Dorado Canyon, 28 minutes to climb out of a Devil's Thumb, or as you break it down.
Into sections, small bite size.
And it gets down to even smaller. Oh, can I make it to the next tree?
Yeah.
You just break it down, and over the years, as you train and as you do the race, you file those in memory until, you know, as long as your brain's working during the race, you'll keep yourself moving.
Yeah, and the original GPS is Dana Gard.
Absolutely.
Well, not particularly me. I mean, there's...
Yeah.
Well, for us.
We all, you know, we pass on.
But sure. How did...
We pass that on, but you develop it yourself, and it's like, okay, now I know that. I know this. Yeah. I know that.
How did you acquire all that? How did you know this rock is, you know...
From being out on the trail and just remember... How many times did I step on that rock?
Yeah.
Training?
I mean, because also with every landmark with a fellow like this, there's an anecdote.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we used
to, yeah.
I don't know. I always had a decent sense of direction as far as reading a map or getting somewhere or something. And when I came out on the trail, I just seemed to notice more things on the trail as we went. And
well, he's an engineer. We expect
right.
A spreadsheet in his head.
There was part of those things
I think so
that helped do the detail work and it helped. It did help a lot over the years as the race went on. We can remember if you can remember what the next milestone is, or how far the aid station's out, or how many minutes it cuts it down to. Like, okay, we got here. We're in good shape now. We've got 25 more minutes to the top of the next hill.
So Dana, how come aid station workers don't know how far it is to the next aid station? I mean, don't they? Really?
I think they do, but it depends on how the runner looks when they come in.
Yeah.
If they look wasted and a little disheveled, yeah, it's only a half a mile to the next aid station.
It's an estimate. And they are volunteers.
Oh, that's true.
And they come from different walks of life. And how many of them are the ultra runners that wanted to be in the race?
Yeah.
If they did, if they're not in the race, they're pacing somebody. So
yeah. Were there always pacers in the race? Was that so?
They've always allowed a companion in the race from Forest Hill in.
Mm-hmm.
Even when the race went through Todd Valley and all of the different changes in the different courses, it always is kind of like, okay, if you're at Forest Hill, you can have a pacer for the last 38 miles or whatever the distance.
What do you guys think about the... Some races require the pacer to be behind, and some races, it doesn't matter if you're in front or behind. You've read that in some race rules,
mm-hmm,
where their pacer must be trailing only. Do you have any thoughts, mm-hmm, on that?
Well, it doesn't really bother me unless you're a front runner, which is the top, mm-hmm, five people.
Yeah.
That's up. It should be up to the choice of the runner where you want your pacer to run.
I agree.
I agree with that too.
More comfortable. Yeah. It's not, they can be poking you in the butt as well as dragging you along to the front. So to me, it doesn't really make a difference. It's just a preference of the runner.
What's your preference, Dana?
I prefer them in front of me.
Yeah.
You know.
Scott?
Oh, absolutely in front of me.
In front.
Takes my mind off it. All I need to worry is about the guy in front of me shoes,
yeah,
and if I can stay up with him.
Yeah.
I like him behind with a little whip, but I want them to be quiet as well.
But that's another story.
Yeah. That's,
you know, there's a question for you that has changed quite a bit, I would assume. Music.
Yeah.
Listening
to
music. You guys are anti-music or music proponents?
I'm a little anti-music. I kind of don't like it when you come up behind somebody and
they have no idea you're
Hi,
there.
Hi, how you doing? Hi, how you doing?
Yeah.
Coming.
On your left.
And then you have to yell when you finally figure out that they're plugged in.
Yeah.
And I know that it's a different culture than I grew up in. I'm almost 70 years old, so it's a different culture. I still don't own a music device.
Thank you.
I think we know Steve's hand already.
Guys like Tweetmeyer that have run with him all the time.
He had a Walkman with a tape deck.
Yeah, I mean
he used to listen. He used to listen to the Giants game.
Yeah. He'd listen.
Oh,
to
really?
Games.
Oh, absolutely.
I don't begrudge anybody that does that. It's just there's got to be a way of being aware that the majority of the people aren't aware, and it's not just during a race. It goes out onto the trails, out in the middle of nowhere, where I've been out on training runs by myself over the years, and like I said, Nisi Marks and Aptos Creek, that place down there, I go run there all the time. Well, I'll come along, catch somebody hiking or something, and good morning, good morning, good morning.
And talking to yourself.
Yeah, and I'm really down with the ambience of the mountains. Uh-huh. That's a big part. That's the big draw for me. Getting away from all of this sprawl and this nonsense down here, this confusion.
I listen to mountain sounds on my MP3 player.
You do?
Yeah. He has ambient.
Waterfalls.
Yeah. Ambient tracks on your iPod.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, I know that they're here to stay, and that's not a problem. I just don't want them to get mad when I scare them. Coming from behind, when you come up on them, and they get a little perturbed at you, and it's like, well, gee.
Yeah.
I used to catch somebody, and we'd talk for 10 minutes, but now they're like ticked at you because you scared them because
you've interrupted their mood.
Yeah.
Hurry and pass me so I can get on with my song. Yeah.
Exactly.
And rattlesnakes have rattles for a reason.
That's you need to be aware of your environment.
Yeah. I mean, somebody that has headsets on and is grabbing his leg. I don't know if I'm going to offer all the help I'm supposed to.
You bet.
Can I edit that out?
I've had close calls out there with rattlesnakes. So.
You bet. Have you?
Yeah.
I have kind of a, maybe, I don't know if this is a right philosophical question, or how do you guys feel about the popularity that ultra running has become? Do you think that's a good thing? Do you think it's a bad thing? Do you think that? I'll just open that up.
I think it's fine. We came along and started doing it, in the late 70s, early 80s, and the only reason we were running was because of Frank Schroeder in the 1972 Olympics.
Mm.
We watched.
You're gonna have to expound on that. I don't know that story.
Frank Schroeder won the marathon in the 1972 Olympics. Well, that opened up the first wave of running nationally.
Okay.
So yeah, we started running to help us physically and whatever. And we never thought we'd all be Frank Schroeders and everything. But that was kind of the first wave of running. So now running has becoming even more popular again. And everybody's like got to the marathon. It's where do we go now?
Yeah.
Just like we did, but we did it in smaller numbers. It's being done in larger numbers now. And it's kind of because of the corporate world, which has, the shoes are better, the bottles are better, the packs are better, the equipment's better, the socks, everything. And people just kind of move up together from, once they find their running partner, okay, let's try something else. And I don't know, it's kind of like there's 10,000 people in the marathon. I got tired of running the marathon. Let's go to the trails.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's starting to clog the trails and clog the events and making it harder to get into all the events. Just had the draw for the Western States December 8th. For next year's run, and there were 2,300 applicants for less than 400 slots.
Yes, 7% chance of getting in or so with just one ticket.
Yeah, and it's kind of disheartening that it's like, well, if I ever wanted to run Western again, it might take 10 years to get in.
Right.
Yeah, the 10-year belt buckle is not going to happen unless you're a front runner up in the top 10. You know, the 10-year belt buckle to...
No, I absolutely know that.
It would be very hard to achieve that.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It won't be as easy to achieve if you can't get in. There are guys like a friend of ours, Scott Mills. Scott was
superb.
Great race director down in Southern California.
Superb athlete, maybe 63, 64.
Yeah, right.
Scott lived here for a few years. We trained together and did some stuff. And very nice gentleman. Well, he had the worst luck on the draw. It seemed like it took him forever to get the 10-year buckle because he just couldn't get drawn. And he'd have to be the two-time loser every time. Before they'd finally get it.
20 years to get 10
so
races.
It probably took him 18.
Wow.
And with the way it's going now, it's going to take much, much longer than that.
Right. 60 years.
You know, to achieve the 10-year buckle. But unless you are a front runner and qualify by the Montreal Series or whatever things that might be available to some of the front runners.
Steve, what do you think? Yeah. Popularity, do you have an opinion?
I don't have a problem with it as long as I have a problem with the numbers of the local races now. Mm-hmm. The upcoming Cool event, the AR event, from the vantage point of the environment, and I hope that the environment can sustain that load of traffic and individuals. And I'm very happy for all these youngsters, and they're youngsters in my eyes, who got in the other day at the drawing and all of that. I think it's terrific. But Dana and I have seen it from a different perspective and a really wonderful perspective, and we've alluded to that today. And I miss that. This Western States, I adore it. I love it. I carry it. I cherish it. It's become way too fancy. I miss the face of Tim Tweetmeyer, and I miss the bellowing of Norm Klein, who would disqualify people forever for the slightest thing.
Minor infraction, you're banned. No suits for you.
We didn't have a committee. Nothing. And
it started out as somewhat of a Northern California event, but other people started, oh, okay, this is cool. Let's try that.
Yeah.
But now it's an international event.
And well, and as a perspective, I think Don was at the lottery. I was not. And he said that by his count, only one person from Auburn got drawn.
A gentleman who I had never seen before. I didn't know the fella.
So one local from the city that started the whole thing got drawn. Yeah.
This was a big year for Oregon and Portland, Oregon. It was crazy.
Yeah,
which is great for those folks, but we're missing that flavor. Mm-hmm. But time goes on.
You know, I have another interesting question, just from your point of view. What single piece of equipment has changed over the years that you think,
besides the mustard bottle,
I can't believe that we never thought of this, or now that this piece of equipment is here, that's just...
Well, how about this Hoka shoe? How did I ever run Western States without a pair of Hokas?
Have you tried them?
Oh, absolutely.
And you like them?
Oh, I think they're great. But my goodness, it's quite different from what the Nikes and we were running in the day.
Let's talk about the shoe.
They didn't have trail shoes back then, did they?
Yeah,
I just run road shoes.
They had waffle trainers, and Nike was the only one that had a little bit of a grip on the bottom with their waffle pattern, and...
Was blistering a problem then?
Until we learned to run with an oversized shoe.
Yeah.
You know,
the big toe box in the front.
Right, with more toe box in the front.
We had years where late into the race, people would just cut the toe box out of the shoe.
Yeah, I've seen pictures of that.
My partner Mike Hernandez would do that. Yeah. His feet would be bloody and just this horrible death march, and we're cutting the shoes up.
But there are guys that wore... You thought, well, a training road shoe. No, they wore track shoes, or
like racing flats. Oh,
Jim Howard, a gentleman that still
for 100 miles they ran in racing flats.
Bruce LaBelle, he's Bruce Lavelle. Yeah. Bruce just came back.
He's still at it.
He's working on his 10th buckle.
Wow.
Or, well, he got his 10th year finished, but he wants his 10 under 24, and he's going after that this year. And if you look at his feet at the starting line, he'll probably have some racing flats on.
Wow.
And but guys like Jim Howard and Lavelle and King and some of those, they wore that type of a shoe. The rest of us, we were using a regular road running shoe for years, and I didn't think it was a problem. You know,
how has training changed? The many miles, were you heavier on miles? Did you cross train? I mean, there's so many different things and philosophies these days. What were you guys doing in the early, you know,
well, period? Basically, one long run on the weekend. Uh-huh. Between 30 and 35 miles, maybe 40 miles in the early years, and runs at lunch hour, and then a little speed work on Tuesday night of about 10 to 13 miles.
Uh-huh.
And that was most of it. Most of the times it was running about 75 to 80 85 miles was the type of training I did.
Uh-huh.
There after a couple of years of running Western, then I moved it up to maybe 85 and once or twice in the 90s to 95, a couple of weeks of that, and that would be it. It wasn't 150, 160 miles for guys like me anyway that wanted to save their legs. I got away from marathoning, went to the trails so that my running career would last longer. Because I enjoyed it. I enjoyed being with the people. And then find out I enjoyed being out on the trail a lot more than trying to...
The urban pavement
of running a marathon. And I've run over 40 marathons. I don't know how many exactly. But, I've got a good PR, but I knew I wasn't going to get much faster without chancing injury because of the work it took to take a few minutes off once you're down in the, in the six-minute range. And I stayed with the trails and I enjoyed it because I said I was going to do Western and then go back Western once and then go back to the marathon. That doesn't happen, and you'll probably talk to most of the older runners. They were going to do the same thing, and they stayed with the trails.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think that's what happens to most people.
Yeah.
They get out there and see the trees and the dirt, and they
you
stay
bet.
There. That's what happened to me.
So how many months did you guys start off? With, you know, how many months would, because right now the drawing went, people are looking at their 100 miler, you know, halfway through the year, right? It's 6 months away plus, right? And they're already out there putting in some miles and getting going now.
We'd start in January.
We'd start in January, and we'd, you know, our long run would be about 20 miles.
Yeah.
You know, but it'd be awfully easy.
And the other thing that we were mindful of is overtraining.
Right.
We don't want to overtrain because in the early days it was all about miles. And from my standpoint and my partner's standpoints, we wanted to peak physically, training-wise, intellectually, emotionally on race day. Mm-hmm. There were some Western states I would be out there and I had peaked in May. Mm. And I was tired. I was listless. I didn't have the fire. But in my last Western states in 07, got heavy into the cross training, the Pilates, the yoga, the speed work on the track, not as many miles, and I wouldn't have finished and done as well as I did absent all of those extracurricular things outside of the running.
You said
so the concept really then is training smart. Every piece of training, whether it's running, whether it's the Pilates, whether it's your yoga, has to have a specific purpose vis-a-vis the event. It's not just about putting the time in. You're working on some aspect of your physique, your head, your leg turnover, whatever. And just like running the race smart, you train smart.
That's wise.
Yeah, in the mid 80s, I belonged to Willow Creek, it was a tennis club over on Manzanita and Fair Oaks. And they put in a gym, a Nautilus gym. It's the first Nautilus equipment, I said, so 83, 4, 5, 6. I used that Nautilus equipment with the idea of building endurance, not building bulk, and it helped. I mean, we could go out and do after a 50-mile race or something, and you come Monday or Tuesday, you could go over and do a workout just because you recovered faster. There are other things to do besides just go out and run on the trail. You need some of the cross training. In my later years, I got involved in mountain biking, but I wasn't running the Western at the time when I was doing the mountain biking, but I was still doing a lot of running at the time, and it helped cross training wise, but I never really got to press that in 100.
Mm-hmm. I thought you were going to tell me that your tennis was cross training.
There you go.
In the early years, it was. I played tennis up.
He was a very good tennis player.
The first maybe 5 years of running, but I'd done a couple of Westerns, and I was still playing a little bit off and on. But eventually, it's like, nah, let's other things got involved.
Steve, earlier you said you need to peak mentally and intellectually.
Absolutely.
Can you expand on that a little bit?
For me, it is always running with an edge. I have to have a purpose. I have to have something gnaw at me when I show up at that starting line, a real purpose. I can't show up vacant.
Uh-huh.
You have a game face and you put it on. I'm a trial lawyer by profession. I operate in the criminal division, and it's the same thing there. There's tons of purpose there for me every day. So I try to take that, extrapolate that. If I'm running for my father, if I'm running for some other individual, something that's really motivating me. But I factor that into Western States. I'm not on race day out there to be a tourist.
Right. So every race, you come up and fabricate or create or identify some purpose to be there.
Yes, 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 absolutely.
Would you agree with that, Dana?
Oh, definitely. I mean, Western States is a different animal than just any other ultras that we do, the 50-milers or the 50Ks or whatever. Western States is so much more demanding of yourself mentally. And the first 50 miles of the race is physical. The last 50 miles of the race is mental. And what you've saved and prepared yourself for that last 50 miles.
So what I hear you...
And the trail gets very temperamental out there. Yeah. I liken it to a woman.
Yeah.
But in terms of the weather, in terms of the terrain, in terms of something unknown is always going to happen, something you didn't anticipate is going to happen, and how you recover from that. So you have to have your stuff together.
It is a woman, isn't it, Steve?
It can be.
I never really
And it can be a woman scorned. And if she's in a bad mood, there could be problems. But you just go on. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
It's a good thing Faith isn't here.
Dana, you said the first 50 is physical, the second 50 is mental. And so if you don't come with the mental edge that Steve's talking about, the second 50 isn't going to happen like you want it to.
It's not going to happen the way you want to because you fried yourself up by not paying attention in the first half.
Mm-hmm. Wow,
and
good.
You definitely lose a lot of it in the second half. I mean, Tim Tweetmeyer is known for his second half comebacks in the wins and many wins that he had out there.
Mm-hmm.
He was tough mentally and laid back the first half and used the second half of that race.
You know, we just finished a podcast recently where we talked about that motivation to compete at the 100-mile distance and having a purpose. One of the guests was questioning her motivation to continue running 100-mile distances, that she initially had that drive. In your careers over the decades, did you ever lose that? Or did you always have something that pushed you to the next race, to the next finish?
I had a point where kind of like I had said, maybe I shouldn't do this anymore.
Uh-huh.
And I think at one point it says, I think I'm done. But I squeezed one more out of it when I turned 60.
Uh-huh.
And I'm glad I did. I'm glad I did. And I think I finished running Western with dignity.
Uh-huh.
After many years of hanging around the event and being a part of the event, participating in the event as a runner, as a volunteer, as a trail worker, as a member of the Board of Trustees for 11 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think I put some energy. I feel I put my own energy into helping the race. I'm really humbled by you guys in this podcast. You know, this is kind of a neat situation, you know, and that you guys recognize that some of us older guys still have something to contribute to this race. That's talking to the guys, not to guys and gals. We come around and look. We were at the draw and everything. It says, "Geez, I know one guy here. It's the race director." You know, it's with that change in that, and it's kind of starting to feel like, well, I guess I'm creeping away from the event to a point, but I do hope to be involved in it for many years.
How about you, Steve?
I've stepped away from it at times because for me it's all about the why question.
Yes.
And I'm asked frequently now, well, you're going to run it this year, you're going to run it next year, and I tell people I can't get by the why question.
Mm-hmm.
Why do I need to do this? I've done it at age 60. And so there is this evolution. I love working at Devil's Thumb on race day, among other things, with Dennis Zyloff and all of that. And for me now, this is my Western States experience, okay? Mm-hmm. Sitting in a room with my friend Dana Gard or all of our other buddies, and this is where we are in that. So the event continues. The lore continues. The stories will be there forever.
Right.
And we have crossed that finish line several times, many times. And now it's up to you folks and the younger folks. And I cherish these times with my friends.
Well, I have to tell you, and those loyal to listening to this podcast know the reason why Don and I started this initially was we were running down the trail one day, and we always are talking about, hey, Dana Gard taught me this, Julie taught me that, la, la, la. And we said, you know, we would like to give back. I mean, there's a lot of things that we learned. When I first started trail running, I didn't have a mustard bottle. They said, if you're going to do this, you need to go get an Ultimate Direction bottle with a handheld holder. And, you know, that was just what you did. I mean, the learning curve for me was much quicker because of all the things that people had learned before and taught me. And when Don and I started this podcast, we thought there has to be a venue where we can get people that have taught these things to us and share that with more people and a broader audience. And that's the whole reason we started this. And that's what when you were saying that those women in Cool helped you motivate you to get out there early in the mornings or whatever and train. Sometimes this podcast is what motivates me to get up early in the morning.
Yeah, we're not allowed to podcast unless we run that day.
Exactly. that's one of the rules we have. Yeah, we have to run the morning that we do these podcasts.
Because you can't go in as a poser. You have to have done it. Now, you guys are talking like you're, you know, ancient, but I got to tell you, we know you've told us you're both at least 60. You know, you guys are youthful. I look across the table, and this is what we find in the community, in the ultra community. We've talked about it several times, Scott, out on a run, saying, I don't care how old the guys are. You know, there's 60-year-olds and 70-year-olds out there, and there's occasionally an 80-year-old that we get to see, and Helen Klein that's out there. And I can tell you, to the person, there isn't an old person out there. They are youthful at heart. Their energy's on their face, and there isn't anything old about them. And that's one of my goals and reasons for staying with it, because whether you're 30 or 60, there really isn't a difference. People can hang out together. They can mesh together. That a 30 and a 60-year-old can share time together. And gosh, those 60-year-olds look good.
Well, you know, we saw that in Unbreakable,
mm-hmm.
the movie where they talked about, you know, Jeff Rose was talking about the people that he runs with in Alaska. And I'm going to reiterate this for people that have listened to the podcast, but I'll tell these guys. You know, one of my favorite parts of running fire trails this year was mile 40 or so. I'd been trading positions with an older gentleman, and I finally just stopped or ran next to him for a long time. And I said, you're inspiring me here. You know, what's your name? And we started talking, and this gentleman, I can't even remember how old he was.
He had his headphones in?
No, he didn't.
Okay.
Of course not. I took mine off and hidden too.
Yeah, I would too.
But he was telling me he was in his 70s, I think, had taken like 10 or 15 years off from trail running or racing, I should say. I think he was always, you know, staying fit. But he said he hadn't run a race in like 15 years, and he decided, you know what, this is a race that he'd wanted to run for a while. Here he is, 70 years old, running a 50-mile freaking race.
Yes.
And I just had a ball talking to this
named
guy.
For a marvelous individual, by the way.
Yes, Dick Collins.
Dick Collins, who Dana and I knew, who was an exceptional runner, an exceptional athlete.
Gentleman.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
But that's just the thing that, I mean, right now my heart rate's probably at 180 just thinking about how
high heart rate.
My resting heart rate's 150.
Yeah, has this happened to you guys? And I throw this out there sometimes, and I'm the only guy that happens to. I fall on my face on this one. But have you guys been running behind someone then adjacent to them, and you've looked at their legs and you go, "Man, that dude is in shape. That is a youthful, strong set of legs." And then you take a glance to the right once you get to them. And there's some gray hair there, and there, you know, you can see that they're a couple decades older.
Age and experience.
But those legs look like they're still 30.
Right. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's so empowering.
Yeah.
It's so wonderful, and it's such a gift to be around people like that.
But you can't have that unless you just keep running and you keep at it and you stay consistent, right? It doesn't just stay there. You have to invest in it.
You bet. You bet. But run with a purpose.
Run with a purpose.
Yes, sir.
Before we may be extending beyond your time, but Dana, you have got to share one of the big takeaway for me, and that is 25-25. I mean, there isn't a hill that
on our morning run today, Don said 25-25 is coming up, Stagecoach. He said 25-25s, and I knew already that. He learned this from Dana Gard.
So Dana, give it to us.
I'm so anal that I started counting
his steps.
How many strides I would take, my left foot strides at each stride. And it depends on the steepness of the hill, whether for the walk around or, you know, other people use a tree or a rock, and I'll run to the next rock and the next tree. But I would kind of keep it steady, and I would do 12 to 16 to 24 walk strides, and then I would do 25 run strides, 30 run strides. I'd do 50-50. I'd do 30-70, depending on what the hill would let you do or let you get back. So if I ran the whole hill, I'd be slow going down the back side of that hill.
Huh, yeah.
As I found over the years. So you know, we just had to learn to rock around.
So these numbers that you're spitting out, the 70s and 30s, the way that it was originally taught to me by you was on the left foot, when you're running, you count just the left foot striking.
Yeah.
But when you then you transfer to walking, you count both the left and the right.
No, I still count the left foot striking.
Yeah, all this time?
Wait a minute.
That's kind of why, Dana.
You just blew this whole model out of the water.
I have been only counting one foot on running and both feet on walking.
I could have more rest this morning, Dana. I was running with you.
There's a difference between steps and strides.
All right.
but basically, most of the time, it's one-third, two-thirds. One-third, two-thirds, you know, on all the hills around here.
I'm going to have to compare all my notes against the things that I thought I knew that you had taught me. One thing Dana can do is clear a trail better than anybody. In fact, Scott did that to me today. And so he's picked up on it. There's a pine cone or a rock in the trail. Is this true, Steve? Have you seen this? And probably you do it yourself. Right in the middle of the trail, and Dana's ahead of you, he'll take his rear leg and kick that, and he can launch it.
That would be my partner, Mike Savage. Judge Mike Savage can kick a field goal like that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Everybody's caught on to...
Yep.
Some people call that their trail maintenance.
Yes.
I get 8 hours of that, right?
Yeah, that's right.
They counted an 8-hour run as trail maintenance because they kicked a few rocks off the side of the trail.
Some people think they can get away with that.
there isn't a single person here or listening that can't extend some knowledge to another runner.
Yes.
I mean, it doesn't. You don't have to have credentials for 10 years and be tenured and all these things. You know, there isn't anybody that that can't share a component or a piece of what they have with somebody else. And I might even be able to share something with Dana. Definitely. I don't know. It would take a while, but I might have a little something that I learned from somebody. So I encourage others to get out there and talk to one another. There's a runner out there. Take the earbud out. Say hello. Introduce yourself. You may need that person to help you through some tough times up front. You don't know. Maybe they need something, and you'll dial into that and perceive that just from the conversation, and you can help them and keep them in the sport so that when they're 60 and 70, they're looking like these two gentlemen next to me. 60. I didn't call anybody 70, but we all hope to approach 70.
Well, thanks for listening, Steve and Dana. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Trail Runner Nation members, thanks for coming on board with a little trail run with us. Go to our website. If you have some comments, don't forget to leave those on the comment section of the podcast.
Perhaps submit your piece of advice that you have, your favorite.
Maybe that's the question of the week for the week of this podcast, is what one piece of advice have you learned from a mentor?
Perfect. Let's log that. That would be awesome, and we'll share it. I'll read every one of them.
And I
was just blown away that I've been doing this 25 wrong. All, you know how many other steps I could have taken in some of those hard, hot days, Dana? You weren't very clear on that.
I got to save something.
He was setting me up, wasn't he? That's how he beat me in all those races.
That's right.
You have to be wiser.
That's right. Well, hey, make sure you go out and run.
Mas.